Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, a weekly public affairs series featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute which encourages excellence in scholarship and seeks to affirm the importance of the humanities in American life.
There's been quite a bit in the last 10 years, I think, but it's interesting why it's been neglected or at least resisted, you know, Chaucer's relationship with Italy. Now, there was an article written in the 50s saying that Chaucer used a French crib and anyway didn't know Italian. But if you just put the Italian text next to the English, you see there's a massive and continuous influence of the Italian on the English at every level of phrasing and syntax and prosody all the way through.
My project is to sort of trace in social relations, in political structures, in effect to test this notion of a new age. In Venice from about 1300 to the first half of the 16th century.
Politics and culture during the Italian Renaissance, this week on Soundings. My guests are Stanley Hojnotsky of Michigan State University and David Wallace of the University of Texas at Austin. First, Stan Hojnotsky discusses marriage and the family in Venetian society between the 14th and 16th centuries. Following that, David Wallace discusses his work in progress, a study entitled Geoffrey Chaucer in Florence and Lombardy, Political History and Poetic Form. According to Stan Hojnotsky, Venice during the Italian Renaissance had a strong sense of itself as a world in transition. This awareness extended beyond the political and the economic to changes that were occurring in marriage, the family, gender, and sexuality. Here is Stan Hojnotsky.
I think marriage is probably the most important social factor is. And in the Venice that I'm looking at, it's also a very important political fact. The thing you have to start with is that most societies are organized, as everybody knows, around families. Our own society is organized around families, although we spend a little less time talking about the legal framework of our family existence. But certainly, we orient ourselves, you know, when we get to the holidays, anytime around families. We deal with families all the time.
It's like the novel. We've been told that it's been dying for a long time.
It goes on. So families really can be looked at, should be looked at in two ways. You know, there's the family we're born into and the family that we create or participate in the creation of through marriage. And that's a powerful difference. In the period that I'm talking about, families have an enduring identity over time. In my research on the Venetians in the 14th and 15th into the 16th century, there's a real turning point that takes place around 1400. Around 1400, you begin to see that group that identifies itself as aristocratic, the ruling class, in other words, starts legislating for itself barriers between itself and the rest of the population, political barriers. Nobody else can, members of the populace cannot participate in things that patricians participate in. I tend to call the aristocrats patricians.
They didn't want other people coming into this equation.
Exactly. Partly because there were benefits that they derived from their status that they didn't want to share with anybody else. Partly because the general background is there's a tightening up of rules, a regulatory environment in Europe at this time, especially in Italy. But the point I'm getting at is at the time that this happened, at the economic significance, the political significance of belonging to this class, at the time that this takes place, you find marriages between members of this class and the other elements of the population, the non-aristocrats, beginning to die down. Matter of fact, I've got about 16 families that I've been following fairly closely. 16 clans.
Tell me about some of them specifically. Be anecdotal for me. Tell me about, put some flesh and blood into the conversation.
Well, I can tell you about matter of fact, an important point about the aristocratic families is that they had legal status that affected their marital activity. You know, they all try to be as aristocratic in their marriage as well as in their genealogy as possible. Some of them couldn't. Some of them didn't have the cash. They had a hereditary title to aristocratic status, But they couldn't make it stick in terms of the practical affairs like raising dowries for their daughters.
Uh-huh.
You get some real in wills. Wills are a wonderful source of information because, you know, people are really dealing with the ultimate reality, especially in view of the fact, as I mentioned a moment ago, that they really have this consciousness of preserving the family over time. You get real bitterness. Matter of fact, I've seen that word, amaritudine, bitterness. This man, a certain Giovanni Morosini, writing his will in the 1440s, I think it is.
What's he angry at?
He's angry because he is really feeling ashamed. He's an aristocrat from one of the oldest families in Venice, but he's dirt poor. He says, I have no money to give to my sons. Most importantly, I have no money to raise a suitable dowry for my daughter. So what he's doing, through mismanagement, bad luck, whatever it might have been, what he's doing is admitting that although he's a member of a distinguished old family, probably 10th century aristocratic family, here we're talking about the 1440s, it's an old family, it breaks down. His custodial activity for this family has proved a failure because he can't marry his daughter. Not only can he not marry her at the level that is required, and you need pretty high dowries. Dowries are going up because of the same attention that I've been talking about to marriage.
Mm-hmm.
He can't give his daughter a dowry that would allow her to marry at the upper reaches of the aristocracy that would seemingly constitute his and her birthright,
mm-hmm.
but he can't marry her at all. And he can't even put her in a convent.
You make me think of the equation, elusive as it may seem to us, between the public and the private. Which comes first, in effect? Does the shape of public events shape our private lives, or is it the other way around?
They're constantly reinforcing each other.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the reasons that I'm attracted to the study of a hereditary aristocracy whose birthright, preserved over generation, is running the city, enjoying prominent status in this, you know, magnificent city of Venice, probably the most prosperous place in Europe,
yeah.
The richest place in Europe at this time, and very, very powerful, commanding a huge empire all throughout the Eastern Mediterranean.
Uh-huh.
Public and private in an aristocracy can't be distinguished. The political alliances on the basis of which this class runs the city are reinforced and knitted together and find expression in marriages. The social connections that are established through marriage and find lots of expressions, support for private enterprise, support for nieces and nephews, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
They get reinforced and in the public sphere. So that's why marriage is so important, because every marriage is a potential reshuffling of political alliances in this class,
yeah.
of economic associations in this class, even of some of the genealogical differentiations.
What about mm-hmm. elements such as sexuality and gender definition? Those are what fashionable, interesting things for you historians to look at here in the
fashionable, interesting. I would say indispensable. If you're going to look at public and private.
Uh-huh.
The only way you can do that is by being attentive to gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because gender is the one thing we've got. How society develops its expectations of the way men act, how society develops its expectations of the way women act.
All right, but now let me stop you, Stan. Yeah. I mean, we have a sense of that because it is part of our political and ideological culture. Are we imposing it backward hundreds of years in time to say that there is a comparable awareness on the part of the Venetians?
I don't think we have to say that there's an awareness to find it there ourselves.
They talk about it. They're explicit about this.
Oh, yeah, there are expectations of female actions.
Huh.
But because we're attentive to it, because we, you know, somebody coined the phrases for us, gender, patriarchy, all those things are very important.
They existed. They were real.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
What we can see, because we know these terms, we have these terms, we can sort of see how people interact with the norms, the expectations of men and of women. Often you find them conforming. Often you find them in nonconformity.
Uh-huh.
And that tension between what society expects a man to do and a woman to do, and what they do,
right.
That is what really reveals how the rhythm of public and private life, how that develops, and specifically for us historians, how the historical dynamic changes, how we get historical change. You know, how, to go back to our original point, if the Italians of that period thought they were different from the Italians of a century earlier, the 12th, 13th century. If the 14th and 15th are different from the 12th and 13th, the Renaissance is different from the Middle Ages, one has to do with an attitude, one aspect of this difference has to do with an attitude toward, similarity to ancient Rome, for example, mm-hmm. which is something they they talked about, but we're interested in finding out if there's something a little more substantial. Right. Did they relate to one another differently? Are relationships different? Uh-huh. At the level not just of the way politics tries to define relationships and tries to place regulations on them, but on the way people sort of pushed, as Tom Wolfe said, you know, push the outer edges of the envelope of relationships.
Right.
You know, to seeing, because when that happens enough, when you get that pressure against existing norms, and when they're inadequate for enough people, the norms change. Mm. Then we get real cultural historical change. And I think that's what I'm finding.
Let's move toward a conclusion, Stan Wynotski. Do we have anything to learn? You know, here we are at the end of the 20th century to learn from this Venetian society?
Sure, I think so. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned a moment ago, we find that people approach marriage in ways that not necessarily are based on, but are sort of consonant with, are consistent with their sense of their lives as they change. You know, the university, kids who go to universities tend to marry other kids who go to universities.
Right.
Shouldn't say kids, they're adults and they get in the university. That's why they're thinking in these terms. But yeah, we learn from that. And another thing we learn, I guess I'd like to think that we learned, is that as you observe, as I observe, marriages over a long period of time, what we can call the sort of matrimonial cycle, you know, from bride and groomhood to young marrieds to young parents to more mature and on to widowhood, you know, people change, people adapt, they're constantly adjusting, and the relationships between a husband and a wife, then as now, are affected by the relationships of each with a wider world. Mm-hmm. And they bring the effects of that contact with the wider world to their relationship with each other. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it's a hardship. But there's growth. Mm-hmm. There was growth in marriage then. There's growth in marriage now.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Stan mm-hmm. Wynotski. As you've been talking about marriage and power, the ruling elites in Venetian society, I've come back in my mind to a couple of scenes in a play called Our Town, Thornton Wilder. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The night before Emily gets married, her parents are talking, and the father says, you know, I've enjoyed being married to you. The thing that I worried about was what I was going to say to you for all those years. Do you have any palpable sense of what marriage was like in those very intimate, concrete sense of
things?
Yeah,
well, I'd say...
To take
the point you made, I would say that there were as many kinds of marriages as there are now. Uh-huh. In some of those marriages, not much was said. In a lot of them, a lot was said. And some of it kind of bad, uh-huh. but a lot of it pretty good. There's a lot of affection, a lot of cooperation, people thrown together, literally, in this case, thrown together,
right.
Managed to sort of latch onto one another and keep each other from falling.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with Stanley Wynotski of Michigan State University. During his fellowship year at the center, Stan Wynotski is working on a study of marriage and the family in Venetian society between 1300 and 1500. Soundings on Politics and Culture in Renaissance Europe continues. My guest now is David Wallace of the University of Texas at Austin. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Wallace is working on a project entitled Geoffrey Chaucer in Florence and Lombardy, Political History and Poetic Form. Here is David Wallace.
The simplest thing is that in Chaucer's work, and Chaucer, you know, is the first major founding father poet of the English tradition.
Mm-hmm.
There's a massive influence by Italian writers, Boccaccio, Petrarch, and Dante, on his work. It's absolutely fundamental.
All right, now what? You have thematic things in mind, for example? What are you after?
As simple as the very idea of what it means to be a poet in your native language, mm-hmm. There was no notion of that, very little notion of that. Before Chaucer got to work in English, the word poet wasn't used. Macer was the word, a maker, you were a maker. So the kind of sophisticated things that the Italians were doing in the 14th century was news to Chaucer and news to English.
What about, for example, the use of vernacular language? Is there a connection there?
Vernacular is very important, that's a good word, because the real distinction is between vernaculars, your native language, your mother tongue, mm-hmm. and Latin.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about nationalism. Chaucer is an English poet, but not an English nationalist poet, like the Victorians thought he was. He's very much a vernacular poet, writing right. in his own tongue. And it's in that vocation that the Italians really helped him.
Tell me about, for example, the connection directly between Chaucer and Giovanni. Is it Giovanni Boccaccio?
Right.
Did they know one another? Is it possible to talk at that level, or are we left at the level of what, exchanging, again, intellectual currents and attitudes?
Well, I should say that Chaucer actually did go to Italy twice. He went on a trade mission in 1372-73 to Genoa and Florence, and he went to Milan in 1378. And Boccaccio was still alive and living just outside Florence in 1373.
So the possibility was there.
It's a possibility. I don't think they would have met. Boccaccio was a bit old and cantankerous.
Why did Chaucer go to Italy? He was a government functionary of some sort.
He was a civil servant, essentially. And there are 500 life records of Chaucer, more than we have of Shakespeare. So we know his movements pretty well. Mm-hmm. And he obviously knew Italian for that job. And he had daily contact with Italian merchants when he worked with the customs service.
Suppose we were to remove the Italian influences that we find in Chaucer, what would it do to him? I mean, does it devastate the work? Does it leave it standing on one leg?
I think Chaucer would disappear.
Is that strong an influence?
Yeah, uh-huh. It really is. Yeah, the very idea of poetry in your native language, worthy of serious consideration, I think is something he learned from the Italians. Certainly narrative, because the French were producing a lyric form and various some kinds of narrative.
But stories with beginnings, middles, and ends.
Yeah, right. And certainly the idea of the Canterbury Tales as a sort of framed collection is inconceivable without the Decameron as a sort of precedent, I think.
Just momentarily, tell me about the Decameron. What goes on? Why did Boccaccio write it? We know that it's an assemblage of 100 narratives. What use did Chaucer make of it?
Well, the Decameron is written shortly after the Black Death of 1348, one of the great catastrophes of world history, wiped out between a third and, say, 40% of the European population.
Goodness.
Also the world population as they knew it. And it's the beginnings of the black slave trade. It ends the population of Scandinavia, the colonization of Scandinavia. It's a great catastrophe. And the mortality rate in Florence was very high. I think the Decameron is an attempt to get over the effects of the plague. It tells how 10 young storytellers leave the city and weather out the plague in its surrounding villa by telling stories of a kind that I think will rejuvenate the society.
Uh-huh. And what use does Chaucer make of that? What does he draw from it?
I think the very conception of a framed narrative, what Chaucer does is gets a body of storytellers and takes them down the road from the Southwark Inn to Canterbury.
It just makes it mobile.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
One of the things that it's fashionable in the Academy today to do, David Wallace, is to look at the political context, the political circumstances surrounding the expressive culture. Do you pay attention to that, and to what degree do you look at the Italian political and commercial climate and explain what's going on in Italian literature in those terms?
Yeah, I think it's an important part of Chaucer's understanding of the Italian texts.
Because he understood the commerce, is that it?
Exactly, and he understood the political context. And what we've done previously in scholarship is simply take an Italian text and get Chaucer's text, put them together, and see what correspondences we can deduce.
And we're going to take it beyond that now.
Yeah, we're going on the road with Chaucer, if you like, and looking at Florence. Chaucer goes to Florence and he finds a republican regime practicing associative polity, which means sort of an ideology of association, of cooperation, a very inclusive regime with butchers and bakers in the government, excluding nobles.
And by contrast, what's going on in England?
By contrast, what's going on in Milan is interesting, because in Milan we have a despotism, the first absolute state of modern times. Hmm. Now, when Chaucer got to Florence, he would discover Boccaccio and Dante associated with Florentine polity. Poets of that kind of political form, and Petrarch, the founder of humanism, associated with despotism. I think it's important that Petrarch, as the founder of humanism, is working for an absolute state.
A perfect state, not necessarily a free one.
By absolute is just a political term. A despotism, if you like, that where authority is downward descending, is from the top down. Well, the position of the poet is very curious, that he, in a sense, has to give over any sense of his text as performing any social or political work, that because all political work is done by the despot, and the poet, in a sense, is written out of it. But Chaucer also has the great opportunity, which writers today have, of being the first. And if you look at Chaucer's language, there's a fantastic sense of elasticity in his language, great sense of anything is possible in Chaucerian language, which you get, again, in, I think, somebody like Wole Soyinka. Just absolute fabulous possibilities where all problems can be addressed.
This is a Nigerian writer, the Nobel laureate.
That's right. Or where the phenomenon, say, of the road that connects Lagos, say, with an outlying area, going through uncharted territories, or that's a road Chaucer's going down, if you like, for the first time poetically. And I think Soyinka's going down it in a different way.
David Wallace, let me ask you to comment upon what the ideological dimension of Chaucerian literature and scholarship. You know, a lot of talk in the academy these days about the ideological circumstances surrounding literature. Is Chaucer ideological?
I think the uses of Chaucer are always ideological because he is a founding father of tradition, unearthed by the Victorians, to be a firm point of origin. That's always ideological. And I think the content of Chaucer's work is also ideological, but it expresses, I think, a conflict of ideologies.
How do you mean? Like a worldview? What are you after when you use a word like ideology?
Chaucerian narrative taken in totality, I think, expresses conflicts, internal conflicts, you know, reflected by the conflict of genres, you know, the difference, say, between the Knight's Tale and the Miller's Tale. Mm-hmm. And I think there are different models of authority operative in Chaucer. There's a sort of belief in an associative polity, an ethos of group cooperation, which the Canterbury Tale certainly embodies, you know, taking a group of people down the road to Canterbury together, regulating their own conflicts. But elsewhere in Chaucer's work, there's also the sense of the poet, the singular individual, being called to account by a figure of authority in the prologue to The Legend of Good Women, for example. And I think that has some level of reference to conditions of working around Richard II, who was accused of being a despot in his later years and was ultimately deposed. Now, that's what's going on inside Chaucer. What's going on in 14th century England is also a kind of narrative of extraordinary conflicts. You have the monarchy, which is deposed. You have the magnates, who are extremely powerful and eventually depose the king. You have merchant capitalists, who are always fighting with the magnates and the king, loath to pay their taxes, but capable of great individual actions, like equipping a whole fleet to protect their vessels. You have the artisans, who will form alliances with the magnates, and have the peasants, who conduct their own rebellion in 1381, and take over the capital. So it's a narrative of real conflicts in Chaucer.
How would you place Chaucer in today's ideological atmosphere? Is that just too much of a leap in time and theme to figure out how Chaucer would, fit into our modern notions of the literary and the ideological?
The category people employ with Chaucer is crisis, that Chaucer is writing within an age of crisis, which is certainly true politically. But crisis is a very comfortable word, exactly, really, because it brings together...
How do you mean?
Well, it brings together a kind of bunching together of conflicts in a sort of convenient knot.
What, you mean like the Cold War, a term like that, a notion like that?
I'm saying that crisis is a convenient and comfortable term because if history is a series of discontinuous strands, that's very unnerving because you can never see them all at once. But if you declare something a crisis,
then
the strands all knot together.
It unites it.
And you can read it like a poem. It's like the well-wrought urn. It's there and you can just have it and read it. I think it's more frightening to think that Chaucer isn't writing in an age of crisis, because crisis always implies resolution. It's a medical metaphor, you know. You have the crisis of a disease, and either you die or you get well, you know.
Right.
But there is no resolution politically to, I think, 14th century England's political crisis for 200 years. And we go into, you know, the next century, we have civil war. So there's just endless conflict without resolution, without prospect of resolution.
Well, how does Chaucer speak to us in the late 1980s and the early 1990s? Is there a sort of parallelism here in the ideological expression dimension of his literary output and the kind of times that we're living in now?
Well, we have the same yearning for resolution. We're always looking for all the strands of history to come together, and we can say, here's the crisis, and now the solution will come.
Yeah, we've had one writer recently say that we're at the end of history because the communist ideological... Communism as an ideology has played itself out.
Right. Well, the end of history is comforting, right? Yeah, because we know what the end is. Uh-huh. What's more unnerving is to live with the unrolling of history and never knowing. I mean, I certainly don't know what's going on in the world now, and the changes are absolutely staggering, you know, all around. And I think that's the experience of Chaucer, too. It's a very defamiliarizing Chaucer.
So we can take some comfort in reading this man.
Absolutely. He didn't know what was going on from one decade or one year to the next. And I think his texts reflect that. There's just this extraordinary juxtaposition in Chaucer between the world of the knight and the world of the miller and the world of Wife of Bath, with no sense that they're going to knot together and form some sort of perfect synthesis.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with David Wallace of the University of Texas at Austin. During his fellowship year at the center, David Wallace is at work on a project entitled Geoffrey Chaucer in Florence and Lombardy, Political History and Poetic Form. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 505. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about animals and the law. My guest will be Gary Francione of the Rutgers University School of Law. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Early June 1784 marked the first recorded free flight in a balloon by a woman. Marie Tible of Lyon, France, flew to a height of 8,500 feet. The Soviet Union this week observes the Pushkin Poetic Festival in honor of Alexander Pushkin's birth in early June 1799. 16 years before that, in early June 1783, a volcano in southern Iceland began an eruption that lasted for 8 months, caused changes in the climate worldwide, and led to a famine that took 10,000 lives. Early June birthdays include Confederate President Jefferson Davis, the Scottish economist and philosopher Adam Smith, the Armenian composer Aram Khachaturian, First Lady Barbara Bush, the French painter Paul Gauguin, the African-American poet Gwendolyn Brooks, and the American actor and diplomat John Howard Payne. It was Payne's libretto, Clarie, or The Maid of Athens, that presented the song Home Sweet Home. Finally, this week marks birthdays for Donald Duck, who was introduced to the world in early June 1934, and for George III of England, the king against whom the American Revolution was directed. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Politics and Culture in the Italian Renaissance, this week on Soundings. Stanley Hojnotsky of Michigan State University discusses marriage and the family in Renaissance Venetian society. David Wallace of the University of Texas at Austin discusses Renaissance Italy and the English poet Geoffrey Chaucer. Cultural currents in Renaissance Europe, from marriage and the family to political history and poetic form. This week on Soundings.